This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the really great pleasure of talking to Ursula Le Guin about her newest book, which is a collection of poetry called Late in the Day. This collects poems from 2010 to 2014 and was published by PM Press. Hi, Ursula. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
So we're talking early in the new year of 2016, and I know you've written poetry for, you know, other collections of poetry, but have you, and you're best known as a science fiction writer, but have you always written poetry, or is this something that...
I wrote poetry first as a kid, years before I tried writing stories. When I was 5 or 6, I've always written poetry, and it's now that I'm 86, it's what seems to remain to me. I certainly can't write a novel anymore. I haven't got the stamina, and the stories don't come, but the poems do. So that's fine.
Do you feel like when you, I was thinking about this a lot as I was reading the book, you know, I'm always interested in how poems appear, and you did talk about process, I was really interested in your the afterword about form and function, and the way that and in some ways, you know, this whole process of how a poem arrives or arises is
totally mysterious.
Yeah, but
it remains absolutely incomprehensible, and You know, you can't do very much about it except be ready.
Yeah.
You wait. You have to have your ear out, as it were.
And do you feel like that the practice, sometimes the writing is itself a kind of meditative practice awaiting the real poem to appear, you know, that there's just a lot of noise before you get signal.
Yeah. It's sort of static, and they're in among the static that, You see some message, as it were. Yeah. So keeping your hand in is, I think, well, with any art, you kind of have to keep your hand in, which means that you may be just kind of spinning the potter's wheel with how much clay on it, you know. But that it's all part of the work.
So are there particular poets that you continue to read today? Are you looking for new poets to read, or are you going back to ones that inspired you in the past?
Well, both. Sometimes a new poet is one whom I neglected when I was younger. They're not literally modern. Contemporary.
Right, but they're a discovery. They can be new anytime they're new
exactly.
To you.
Yeah. Because for some reason, when I was young, I just didn't take to Robert Frost. He was kind of adored and worshipped in New England where I went to college. And I was, there's old Frost, you know. But then, you know, I sort of picked him up within the last 20 years. And he wears really well. He's a very good poet.
Is there anyone else like that that you can
think of?
Well,
I like that, yeah. Thomas Hardy, who is kind of rather the same, a little older in the same generation. And I grew up with Hardy's novels. Lord, I'm reading The Mayor of Casterbridge right now. But I didn't really know his poetry, and it's kind of a revelation. So there's that, and then there's going back to the poets that you always loved. I mean, you know, Keats or whoever, Wordsworth.
And well, you also mentioned Swinburne. I was really amazed.
Oh yeah,
by
that was youthful.
Right.
That was a crush. That was a crush when I was a kid. You get a crush on Swinburne because he, you know, the music.
Right.
And he sort of gives you permission to turn your mind off and just make music. And I think that's important to some poets.
Well, it's the just the sheer beauty of language, and sometimes it takes over, and you know, it's
it
almost
doesn't mean anything,
right?
except it means that that something beautiful is happening, you know. And that's why I say music, because, you know, you can't say what a piece of music means in language.
Right.
Well, of course, right. you really can't end with a poem either. The poem says what it says.
Right, although there is that whole, you know, the kind of English teacher style of reading a poem to get at its meaning, you know, which has some value for people who don't read poetry often.
It makes you think. It's an old teaching device, and there's nothing wrong with it if it doesn't end there. If you don't think that having explicated the poem, okay, you squeezed it dry and it's a lemon rind and you can throw it away. You know?
right. And then you forget
naive teachers and naive students often think that that is the case. But the whole thing about meaning, you know, this is more true with prose than poetry. But people say over and over, I get asked, do you have your message before you begin writing the story, or do you just put it into the story? And I say, huh? You know, I don't write messages. I write stories. I don't have a message. I'm not.
Well, the story, in a way, carries your message, but it doesn't mean that you have to be consciously applying the message to make the story.
Well, a really good story more than carries a message. It simply is the message. And therefore, it's kind of inexhaustible. It can't be reduced to, you can't paraphrase it. You can't say what.
Right. Well, and that goes back to what you said about poetry, that the poem is, and that, you know, its beingness shouldn't be ignored, that by trying to figure out what does it mean, you sometimes fail to grasp its being.
Yeah, for one thing, you don't listen to it. You don't hear it, and I do think poetry must be heard inwardly, with an inward ear or aloud, but you've got to listen to it. Just plain listen, you know.
Well, and quite a few of the poems in this collection, I noticed, are very musical and lyrical in that, you know, kind of traditional sense where, and I don't just mean by rhyming, but by the kind of use of meter and the form. And you talked about that again, that you've taken up form as a way to create content. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit, because I think that's a really beautiful idea.
Yeah, well, it was kind of something that I consciously realized working with a little group of poets that I'm in that we meet once a month. And we give each other an assignment. And we don't have to do it, but we generally try. And often it's been an assignment in form, you know, write a villanelle or write quatrains or whatever, so that we can explore forms we didn't know. And we all sort of began to agree that sometimes those assignments brought out poems that we, the most unexpected work. When it was an assignment to, you know, write about Easter or sort of a starter like that, that's fine, but that the assignments in form brought more variety and sometimes more depth. And, you know, trying to puzzle this out, because I'm old enough that most of my early poems were written, yeah, they rhymed and had meter, because that's what kids kind of respond to in hearing it, you know. And then I grew older and realized that everybody was writing in free verse, and rhyme and meter were kind of old-fashioned. And so, okay, I worked in free verse for a long time, but I always liked rhyme and meter. And there's nothing old-fashioned about it. It just, you can use it. It's there if you want it, you know. And so I sort of went back to it later in life, and then began to discover the endless resources of following a pattern in your poem, and that it does bring out thoughts and language you didn't know was in you. It's a very, again, I can only say it's a mysterious process.
Do you feel that there are certain forms and structures that appeal to you more than others because they just make you, they reflect your own sensibility?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, we all have these kind of unexplainable preferences. Sestina.
Oh, yeah.
The one where you...
Yeah.
I don't like sestinas, and I can't write them. They're too long. The repetition is overdone, is excessive to my ear. The endless repetition of this word, and they're almost inevitably some... You have to kind of do some faking. But a villanelle, which I thought was... Oh, heavens, what a precious form. Oh, my Lord, they're inexhaustible. That's been a very fertile ground to pull a poem that I didn't know I could write out of me. So it's hard to, and I think that the quatrain is an absolutely marvelous little form. I think it's the English equivalent maybe of what the haiku is to the Japanese. It's how you can say an awful lot in a few lines.
Well, yes, and it does, of course, force you to compress, which is, you know, the nature of poetry to begin with. Which reminds me, I wanted to ask you one thing. There were a couple of poems in here that reminded me so much of my favorite poet, who is Laureen Niedecker, and I wondered if you'd ever read her work.
No. Oh. Not a bit.
Oh, it's so interesting because...
Oh, my goodness. Niedecker.
You should.
I know her name.
She's absolutely wonderful. And the poem of yours that I thought really was almost my favorite was the earthenware poem.
The pot.
Yep. And a couple of others I thought just... Amazingly, you know, not that I don't mean to say derivative in any way, but
no,
just that.
No, I know, but so when you hit a similarity like that.
Yeah, I think you would like
intriguing.
Her work. She's very, she was all about observation in the place that she lived, but mm-hmm. also was a very wide reader, as these poems evidence that you are, you know, with all of the references to Greek mythology and Greek characters. I thought was pretty interesting, but I just it was interesting to me.
Thanks for the name, because you know you're always kind of looking for a tip on a poet you haven't read.
Oh yeah, no, she's very rich in that way. So you might find her work interesting.
I will look her up. Thanks.
I also thought that you know the theme of this book so much was about relationships, and I wanted to, maybe you could talk a little bit about your kind of the way you think about human beings today. You know, I think we have similar ideas about that, but I'd really like to hear your thoughts about how these poems reflect your ideas about human beings in relation to the natural world.
Oh, yeah, well, that's sort of the big... the big animal in the room that we don't look at, because he's going extinct. Since finally it has come to our attention that we are wrecking the planet we live on, and not stopping doing so, although we're finally beginning to talk about it, and making Geneva plans to take effect in the next 10 years or something, and so on. Yeah. I have children and grandchildren, and it's not it's not a good feeling to think that their world is going to be harder and poorer and perhaps much more dire than my world was, and that I actually lived in probably the most wealthy and spoiled generation of human beings ever, was exactly my generation. We're beginning, we're just now beginning to come down the other side of that mountain, that peak. And all that is very scary, and I can't handle it, and thinking directly about it, I just get depressed. But out of that material, I guess, rise some poems, which handle the subjects indirectly, I hope.
No, I think they do, and I think that's what made me think of that I think for most of us, it's, you know, the subject of how we can change the way we relate to the physical world, change the way we relate to each other, is such a big topic. It's so difficult to get our arms around and our heads around that in some ways poetry is the best way to do it, because it enables us to overcome the depression and enter the mystery that might allow us to transform ourselves.
Yeah, that's exactly. The trouble with kind of thinking about it directly is you tend to end in paralysis.
Right.
And somehow we got to find small roads around around and through. And I think it's kind of hard for us to think small. You know, we want a great big techno fix. We kind of oversimplify. You think that's right? Our thinking tends to kind of, there's got to be one answer to this, you know.
Right.
Of course, there isn't. There isn't one big answer. There's a whole lot of little answers.
That's true. And I think it is, you know, the meditative quality that you undertook in this book, I think, is part of what enables us to figure out how each of us can act in that kind of context.
Yeah, and attempt to act rightly, you know, to do good rather than harm, takes a lot of contemplating, doesn't it?
I think it does, probably more so than most of us are allowed or allow ourselves. I mean, I did feel like, you know, again, reading these poems, that you were stopping time in order to see things clearly. And the stopping of time is, you know, maybe one of the key problems that we have, that we are, you know, we feel sort of just unable to stop.
Yeah, and that. It's kind of scary to hear young people say that the day's going by too fast and there aren't enough hours in the day, you know, and so on. Because old people, because of sort of weakness, often feel that. But young people are frightened by the terrible pace we're living at. It's too much for them. You know, they get worn out, they get confused. Because they have to keep moving so fast.
Right, and there's no end to the sensory input. And, you know, I think human beings, I mean, one of the things I remember learning this in an anthropology class where we were taught about that humans are, our job is to make sense of all this sensory input that we get. And one of the things that different cultures organize sensory information differently than others. Mm-hmm. But it's all about trying to, because you can't let everything in. There's too much information. So we need, there's only so much that a human organism can manage. And I think that what you're seeing today is maybe that information overload, where the culture has not caught up yet, doesn't know how to simplify and make sense of all of that data and all of that input.
And all the data, all that input is due to the habits of this culture, which insist upon increasing the information load and pouring it upon us day and night. So it's the culture is kind of spinning in its own wheel, driving itself nuts, which is, you know, here I sit with my computer screen 10 inches from me to my left, you know, ready to come on and overload me.
Right, which I am doing the same thing, even as we're talking about, you know, trying to find a way of slowing it down. The tools that we use for daily life tend toward chaos.
Yeah. Now, about 18 inches from my computer, my cat is lying on the top of my desk on his back with his paws kind of in the air, sound asleep, right over the heater. And he is exhibiting to me how to live right. And maybe I'm dragging the cat in here because I think our connection to the natural world that we were kind of trying to talk about here, the animal is such an immediate entrance into that connection.
That is true. Impossible, you know, to not see that if you're around animals.
It's impossible. If you're around an animal, you see it and feel it. Whether you want it, like it or not, it's there, right? And the people who scare me are the people who have just absolutely eradicated animals from their lives, and even trees, plants, and so on, that they are completely human-centered. And is this, has any other people been so human-centered? People, after all, people lived with animals. I had to, because animals were their workforce until only, 100, 150 years ago.
That's true. But even being with animals, or, you know, you can be attentive to the animal, or you can treat the animal as a beast of burden, as you kind of alluded to. I just think of, you know, that the Western culture, the European culture, does suffer from that objectification of the natural world and the objectification of animals within it. You know, they're not just, they're to be used, yeah, hunted, killed, and that
that's
whole.
That's not just us. That's not just the White West.
No, that's true.
Oh, the you know, the whole human animal relationship is awfully complicated, and the relationship of the domesticated work animal and people. I think we rather oversimplify that, as we don't even experience it anymore. A farmer didn't mistreat his oxen or his horse if he could help it, if only because they were his, they did his plowing. You know, people didn't just go around whopping animals and beating them up. And they called them beasts of burden, but they called women that too. You know, I think we oversimplify and look down upon the work relationship that used to exist between animals and people. And then, of course, there's the whole mystery of the hunting relationship, where to so many people, the hunt was a sacred thing, and the hunted animal is a sacred animal. It may be your ancestor, you know.
That's true. No, it's but it's important to remember that relationship and not simply objectify it and kind of separate it.
Remember it, and honor it. And we went in exactly where you're bringing up the West is rings true to me, is that we've tried to replace the animal by the machine. And been very successful doing so. But so now what do we got?
And removed any element of spirituality from the relationship to all things, because the mechanical world is seen as having no spiritual element at all.
But boy, it's sort of a scary idea to think of introducing the spiritual element into the mechanical world. Then you start worshiping the machine, you know. I don't know.
I know that's a pretty strange. I know, but it there is that, you know, that is a possibility if, you know, if you think about where we may end up. It's a weird idea. Well, you know, there are two things I wanted to talk about before we run out of time, but one thing I would love for you to do, if you're willing to do it, is to read Contemplation at McCoy Creek. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, that's a very intellectual one, yeah. Contemplation at McCoy Creek. Seeking the sense within the word, I guessed. To be there in the sacred place, the temple, to witness fully and be thus the altar of the thing witnessed. In shade beside the creek, I contemplate how the great waters coming from the heights early this summer changed the watercourse. The four big midstream boulders stayed in place. The willows are some thriving and some dead, rooted in, uprooted by the flood. Over the valley in the radiant light, a raven takes its way from east to west. Shadow wings across the rimrock pass as silent as the raven. Contemplation shows me nothing discontinuous. When I looked in the book, I found time is the temple. Time itself and space, observed, marked out, to make the sacred place on the four-quartered sky, the inwalled ground. To join in continuity, the mind follows the water, shadows the birds, observes the unmoved rock, the subtle flight. Slowly, in silence, without words, the altar of the place and hour is raised. Self is lost, a sacrifice to praise, and praise itself sinks into quietness.
Ah, that's very beautiful. Can you tell me, where is McCoy Creek?
Well, if you find a map of Oregon and look in far southeast, you will find the only town here of any size at all is called Burns, after the poet. I'm proud to say, and about 35, 40 miles south of Burns is a town of six or seven people called Diamond, and it's not far from there.
And what is it that gets you to go there? Is that a place that you find particularly attractive?
Absolutely fell in love with it the first time I ever saw it. I had never been in high desert before, and I don't know. It was love at first sight. And as we were only there overnight, I think first time we ever went out there, and driving back, I thought, when can I get back? And that's how it's been for 30 years.
Oh, it's great to have a place like that. I think, you know, a place.
Yeah, I got one in California too. So I really am lucky.
Where is your place in California that
it's
has that?
It's a family, old family place in the hills of Napa Valley, which now owned by our kids, but my dad bought it in 1930.
Wow, that's great. It's so nice to have a place in the family that you can pass down through generations. That's a wonderful thing.
It's getting to be a rare thing, and it sure is.
So
everybody knows each other in the family.
Right, and it gives also that kind of continuity of a touchstone that everyone can feel the same. You know, they have their own relationship to it, but it's constant for everyone.
Yeah, and the kind of shared responsibility is a very cool thing.
Yeah, that is. That's wonderful. Well, I wanted to, before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about your growing up. I know that your father was an anthropologist, a very famous one, and your mother was a writer as well. And you experienced kind of growing up with anthropology all around you, but you also knew the man Ishi?
Oh no, he died in 1913.
Oh, so he was before you were alive. Yeah,
my father had Indian friends who stayed with us. One of whom well, I call him an Indian uncle, Juan Dolores, who I had the great privilege of knowing some Native Americans just as friends of the family, as a little white middle-class kid. It's kind of a rare privilege. But I was a very lucky kid. I grew up in a nice town, Berkeley, in a beautiful place, Northern California, with three older brothers and a house full of books.
No, it sounds pretty almost unbelievably ideal.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have said so then, you know. No kid is going to be satisfied with their home and family and so on. But, you know, looking back, it was good. Yeah. And I got a good start.
Well, you said before that you're not writing fiction anymore. One thing I noticed when I looked at your biography and I saw that you had started writing, you were writing novels originally starting about 1950, 51, and that you had written several novels, maybe five is what I read, that were rejected when you were trying to get them published in that time. Do those original early books still exist? Have you ever gone back to them, or are they just, you know?
No, they're... one of them... stayed alive. Early work like that, I'm a slow learner, and that's apprentice work, and it should never be published. And if I think idiots are going to do so, I'll destroy it before I give it to the library to archive. But one of those books stayed alive in my head, and that is the book that was published as Malafrena. And is going to be republished soon in Library of America. So that if sometimes your early stuff has a vitality, I rewrote it completely at least four times. So it was a matter of I guess about 20 years between the first conception and the actual finished book. That's an awful long time for anyone. Work of art to gestate and be made.
That is very long time.
It's very chancy that anything good can come out of it. But I'm still fond of Malafrena. In some ways, is a very young book, but I still like it.
Oh, that's good. I will look for that then. I'll be interested in that. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about this new book of poetry. I really,
it was a pleasure.
Really
Thanks
enjoyed
for
talking
letting me
to you.
Talk.
Oh, my pleasure, really. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Ursula Le Guin about Late in the Day, Poems 2010 to 2014. Thank you so much.